I'm Artie Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Donald Trump is facing a heap of legal troubles involving a series of criminal, civil, and congressional investigations. Last week, the FBI removed sets of documents taken from the White House, some of them labeled top secret, that were being stored at the former president's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. The search warrant indicates that Trump could face a series of criminal charges, including violating the Espionage Act. Trump claimed he had declassified all the documents that had been removed, saying, quote, "They're mine." Today, the federal magistrate judge who authorized the warrant for the FBI to search Trump's home will hear arguments about unsealing the affidavit, which would reveal why he believed crimes had been committed. Now, this is a complicated case with serious implications because we are in many ways in uncharted legal territory. We asked Glenn Gristel to explain how government secrets are classified, how they are supposed to be handled. He's former counsel for the National Security Agency, and he served in both the Obama and Trump administrations. Glenn Gristel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to join.
Nice to have you with us. Let me begin with some really basic nuts and bolts questions. Who decides what documents get classified?
We've got quite a complex and detailed process for deciding how our nation's secrets should be handled carefully and kept away from adversaries. And that goes back to the days of President Truman, and since Republican and Democratic administrations subsequent to that have all followed the same procedures, which is we have a detailed process for making sure that documents get classified into top secret or secret. How they are handled, they can't be removed from secure facilities, how they can be copied, distributed, etc. A very, very elaborate, detailed scheme in place for decades, which, as I said, all presidents have faithfully followed.
Well, a couple of follow-ups here then. For instance, as the commander-in-chief, does a president, any president, then have the right to either classify or declassify documents?
It's certainly true that the president, as the head of the executive branch, has the power ultimately to classify or declassify or direct that. In a way, in this particular case, that may not be relevant because the three statutes that were stated in the search warrant for the Mar-a-Lago search didn't mention classified documents at all. The three statutes that are referenced there don't have anything to do with whether things are classified. But it is true that the president ultimately has that power.
There are several different designations, confidential, secret, or top secret. How distinctively different are those documents depending on that classification?
Well, all those documents would be hard to miss. They're all going to be labeled at the top and bottom of every single page, classified, whether it says secret or top secret or confidential, in red ink and capital letters, the boxes themselves, the cover pages. So they'd be hard to miss. And indeed, the proof of it is that the FBI, when they went in there, were able in just a matter of hours to very quickly locate and identify this material. So it has to be handled properly, and it's very easy to recognize. There's no mystery about it.
Former President Trump has had various explanations for how these documents ended up at Mar-a-Lago. And there are sort of questions about, what they were doing there and why he has resisted giving them back. He had one of his spokespeople go on Fox News who said, and this is a quote here talking about Donald Trump, he had a standing order that documents removed from the Oval Office and taken to the residence were deemed to be classified the moment he removed them. Does that make any sense to you?
The short answer is no, it doesn't. As I said, we've got an elaborate procedure for how to classify, and we've also got an equally elaborate procedure for how to declassify. In fact, in the case of nuclear weapons, they're covered by a completely separate statute which takes away from the president individually the power to make that decision and says you need the concurrence of the secretaries of energy and the Department of Defense just because nuclear secrets are so super important. His idea that when he went upstairs and reached, I don't know, the third or fourth step, that suddenly the documents were just automatically declassified doesn't make any sense. Even if you say he has the pure technical legal power, we have no way of knowing what documents were covered by that. We can't even have any suggestion of what's covered or what's not covered. And interestingly, there are two court cases dealing with President Trump's tweets where he said, I hereby declassify something. And the courts later said, including his own chief of staff, said, oh, that wasn't intended there to declassify it. You need a formal process. And there's been no formal process when you just walk upstairs.
John Bolton told the New York Times, he, of course, was a national security advisor, that Trump is, and I'm quoting here, almost certainly lying about declassifying the records found at Mar-a-Lago.
It's hard to believe there was such an order. It wouldn't really make sense. No one seems to have any record of such an order. And as I said, even if on a hyper-technical sense he said that, it's not going to have any meaning because there has to be a procedure. We have to know what was taken upstairs. It can't possibly be the case that years later he says, oh, I took that piece of paper upstairs, or no, I didn't take that piece of paper upstairs. And if he took up the whole president's daily briefing, does that mean that every single piece of paper in that notebook is declassified? Hard to believe.
We're talking about a variety of documents. We don't actually know what's in them. We know that some of them have been classified top secret. At the same time, who owns those documents? The former president has said they belong to me. Do they belong to him?
Absolutely not. There's no question in the law that these are official government records. They, under the Presidential Records Act, they should be deposited in the National Archives, and that should have happened at the end of his administration. It sounds like it took about a year for that to happen anyway. Yeah. There's no question that these documents are not personal. They belong to the government. And if they're, and there's already been a subpoena requested over the spring to obtain them, that was not fully complied with because obviously the new records were just found. And the president basically is in a difficult situation. Former President Trump is in a very difficult situation. Either he admits that he willfully and knowingly took these government documents in violation of the law, which exposes him to criminal liability, or he argues, gosh, I had nothing to do with this. I didn't know anything. I was just sloppy. I wasn't really paying attention. I just threw stuff in boxes, in which case, all the more reason we don't want our nation's secrets kept in a storage locker off the Mar-a-Lago pool.
Indeed. I mean, it's not only his residence, it's a club. It's a place where people come and go. It seems, I mean, I'm sure there's Secret Service there, but it doesn't seem like a very secure place for some of these documents.
Well, it sounds like at least it was originally quite unsecure. Indeed, the government, after finding out about the existence of some of these documents, specifically asked Trump to put a better lock on it. Yeah. But that doesn't really solve the problem. We can't have a situation where just because there's a good lock, which might be picked or whatever, or cut open, that we're going to rest comfortably knowing that that important secrets are in some storage room where potentially Chinese, Russian, North Korean spies, whatever, might potentially try to get in and access that.
Are we talking about the violation of the Espionage Act of 1917?
We're talking about three statutes. Indeed, it's interesting that the government didn't list in their search warrant the statute, section 1924 of the Criminal Code that relates to classified documents. And I think that's because the government didn't know for sure there'd be classified documents. They wanted to be on rock solid ground. So they listed three statutes, two of which have nothing to do with defense information or classified information, just simply relate to improper handling of official government records. And one, the Espionage Act, Marty, that you referenced, which does cover national defense information, not technically classified information. And, you know, under that, although we think of it as spying for the enemies or giving aid to our enemies, it contains general provisions that say even if you just grossly negligently handle national defense information, that could be a violation of the Espionage Act.
And a crime? Are we talking about potential crimes here then?
These are serious crimes that the government has prosecuted others for. The government has a strong record of making sure our nation's secrets are safeguarded. The Espionage Act has a 10-year criminal penalty for each violation. The other statutes that I mentioned relating to general government records each have 3 years for each violation. So these are very serious. Basically, the government had no choice but to go in and seize these documents. It could not possibly tolerate that these would remain in an insecure facility.
I mentioned in my introduction that we were in uncharted legal territory. I'm not a lawyer. You are. Are we?
Well, not really, in the sense of it is completely standard for the government, when it finds out that some former government employee, whether a senior person or low-level person, has improperly removed documents and taken them home or taken them somewhere they shouldn't be, to investigate, to prosecute where appropriate, and most importantly, to recover the documents. So in that sense, this is a somewhat ordinary case. What's unusual about it, of course, is that it involves A, a president, and B, this particular president. And so that clearly gives it extreme political overtones. But the basic legal principles here are very straightforward.
Now, this federal magistrate judge today is going to hear arguments about whether or not to unseal the affidavit. I believe a number of news organizations want him to unseal this affidavit. The Justice Department does not. What are the pros and cons of that from your perspective?
Well, there certainly is a lot of public interest in this, and so the news organizations that are seeking this have said, gee, this is an extraordinarily important case. We need to know more about it, and that's accurate. On the other hand, it's very clear that while a criminal matter is still in the investigative stage, and let's remember, nobody's been charged with anything in this particular inquiry relating to the Mar-a-Lago documents. This is still in the investigative stage. It is completely inappropriate to reveal details about the nature of the investigation, and that's exactly what the Department of Justice said. They pointed out that a release of the underlying affidavit that explains why they wanted to obtain the search warrant could potentially reveal sensitive information about witnesses, could expose them to personal harm if their identities were disclosed. It could give others, including potential defendants, a roadmap as to what the government is looking at and where the investigation is going. It could disclose investigative techniques, which were not further referenced in their Justice Department filing, and of course violates grand jury secrecy. So there's clear precedent for withholding information at this stage, before anybody's been charged, when release could do damage. Once there's a indictment, if there is, and that's a big if,
sure,
and once there's a trial, that's a different story. Maybe then it's appropriate to release that information. But at this point now, and I suspect the judge will decline to release the material.
We have about 30 seconds here for our listeners tuning in and sort of wanting to know what's going to happen next. What do you think will happen next?
I think the next thing is the judge will probably say, no, I'm not going to release this. And then we're back into more investigation, seeing whether a grand jury thinks there's enough evidence here of a crime to warrant handing up an indictment.
Got to leave it there. Glenn Gerstel, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started and talking about this important issue. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, he's former counsel for the National Security Agency, and he served in both the Obama and Trump administrations. We've got two more guests waiting in the wings and much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And we've been talking about Donald Trump's legal troubles, including the search of his Florida estate last week and the removal of boxes of classified government documents. According to the warrant, the DOJ was investigating whether Trump violated the Espionage Act, as we just heard, or unlawfully obstructed, possessed, or destroyed official materials. Now, this is just the latest in Trump's ongoing feud with the federal government involving White House documents. This is also just one of a number of ongoing investigations he faces. A district attorney in Georgia is investigating efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is a target in that probe and appeared before a grand jury yesterday. And there's more. There are criminal and civil inquiries into Trump's business activities in New York. In fact, Trump took the Fifth something like 400 times when he was deposed by the Attorney General of New York earlier this month. Alan Weisselberg, Trump's trusted CFO, is going to plead guilty today for a longstanding tax fraud scheme that could hurt the Trump Organization. And, of course, there's the January 6th committee investigation. I almost ran out of gas there. We have two guests who have joined us to continue our conversation. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Lauren Oziel. She's professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, a former federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, later in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. Lauren Oziel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And joining us is also Hugo Lowell. He's congressional reporter covering the January 6th investigations for The Guardian. And Hugo Lowell, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
That was a lot to try to shoehorn into an introduction to the two of y'all. Just put it out there. Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Hugo, if I could begin with you, you began basically covering the January 6th committee, and here we are, you know, talking about all these investigations, some of which have morphed from this committee investigation. Seems like we are just in a ever expanding series of investigations.
Yeah, I think certainly everything's snowballed since the January 6th committee first started subpoenaing people in Trump's political orbit. And you know, certainly this current investigation, this national security investigation about Trump's mishandling of government records at Mar-a-Lago, certainly came out of the National Archives request to Trump so that they could satisfy the January 6th committee subpoena for Trump White House records. And so I think one thing has led to another, and now Trump finds himself about a year and a half after the Capitol attack under investigation from all fronts, both federal and congressional.
And to you, Lauren Oziel, I mean, it does raise questions about whether our courts, our legal system, are they equipped to handle, you know, all these investigations of a former president, it should be said?
I mean, certainly the court system is equipped to handle it, absolutely. It's unprecedented, but that, you know, that's just, it is what it is. And, I mean, certainly the court system is equipped to handle it.
You and I were talking before going on the air. One of the things I was complaining about, it just seems like it's just taking so long.
Well, look, I mean, criminal investigations do take a long time, particularly those that are complex and have many different moving parts. And these different investigations, and to be clear, I mean, I know that for people it may seem like these are all sort of part and parcel and they may all sort of overlap and come together in certain ways. But in other ways, they don't, right? I mean, the investigation into Trump's business practices and the Trump Organization is really quite separate, for instance, than the investigation into his mishandling of official U.S. documents and classified information, which is quite different from the January 6th investigation. So all of those are separate, and each of them is incredibly complex in their own way.
Yeah.
There's enormous amounts of documents to be looked at. There's large numbers of witnesses, from what we can tell. And there's the very tricky issue of speaking to witnesses who have firsthand information who the prosecutors want to get to cooperate. And so that can be a very long process, mm-hmm. both in the sense of getting someone in the mental space where they want to do something like that, but also, and really importantly, making sure from the prosecutor's perspective that that person is truthful.
Yeah.
And that involves a lot of, I mean, you never believe what a witness tells you. You have to corroborate it every which way under the sun. And so that takes time.
Going to you, Hugo, and there probably is no direct answer to this question, but it sort of hangs over, which is why former President Trump took top secret materials with him when he left the White House and has fought so hard to keep them. From your perspective, is there an answer to that question? Do we know?
I don't think there's any single answer. I think, you know, the way Trump operates is he has a lot of kind of agenda is not the right word, but I think he has, you know, several different motivations. You know, certainly sometimes with some documents, things like, you know, the love letters with Kim Jong-un in North Korea, like, I think he does see a lot of these things as mementos. I mean, certainly the overarching narrative with the documents and the lack of official records management in the West Wing was because Trump thought that these documents were his. Right. And he treated it as an extension of his business practices when he was in the White House. And so I think when he saw, when he was given these documents in the daily briefings, or, you know, he was given documents by the intelligence community or by any other agency, frankly, at some point he decided these were just his and his to keep, and he could do what he wanted with it. And so certainly when he was packing up the West Wing in the final days of the administration and moving to Mar-a-Lago, we know that, you know, he kind of slaved over packing these boxes. He kind of decided what he wanted to keep, what he didn't want to keep. You know, what he didn't want to keep, he just, you know, tossed and discarded. And then what he wanted to keep, he mm-hmm. packed up with him. And that included, of course, things like the model of Air Force One and the new livery that he had chosen. And then I think also there's obviously some potential motivation here that he wanted to keep documents because a lot of them are very sensitive, and he thought, you know, maybe they could come in handy down the line. Certainly Kash Patel, his Pentagon loyalist, who he named eventually as one of his liaisons with the National Archives over presidential records management, has said that some of the documents he took with him to Mar-a-Lago included documents on the Russia investigation and Hunter Biden, you know, two things that Trump cared deeply about on a personal level, and it sounds like he wanted to keep. So I think there are different motivations here.
And we don't know yet, and certainly there are questions about whether he'd want to monetize that or not. And if I can quickly go back to you, Hugo, I was reading, I think it was either the Washington Post or the New York Times, that since the FBI agents went to Mar-a-Lago and removed some of these documents, he's raised $1 million. He sent out something like 100 emails in order to raise money on what he saw as you know, something, if not illegal, sort of untoward towards him.
Yeah, it's a good story from the Post. I think, you know, this is typical Trump campaign finance. You know, I think his campaign finances were lagging a little bit in the first kind of 6-7 months of this year, not least because he hasn't been really doing very much. But then the moment the raid hit, you know, I'm subscribed to these campaign fundraising emails
me
just
too.
So I can keep an eye on
what's
coming down the line. And you saw a definite uptick, right, in the number of emails that were coming through that were asking for any amount of money whatsoever. And then I think for the first time yesterday, we also started getting emails about Jared Kushner's new book and how you could get a signed copy if you paid $75 or something. So very on brand.
Very on brand, indeed. Lauren, I was talking to Glenn Gerstel about the fact that this judge that issued the affidavit that allowed the FBI to go in is going to hear arguments today about whether to let the public see it or not. Glenn said he didn't think it was a good idea because certain people and issues need to be protected. Do you have a position on that?
Oh, absolutely. I agree. I mean, and agree that it's not going to be released. I mean, I think one of the things that the Department of Justice's brief in response to the intervener's request to unseal the affidavit, and by the way, we should clarify for your listeners,
sure,
the request to unseal the affidavit is actually by media organizations. It's not by Trump. And Trump has sort of indicated he wants it unsealed, but he hasn't filed anything in court. It's unclear. I mean, it would shock me if he actually wanted that unsealed. And so there are important reasons to not unseal it, both with respect to Trump as a prospective defendant who has not yet been charged,
right.
And also, of course, importantly, to protect the integrity of the investigation. That would be unprecedented to unseal an affidavit at this stage of an investigation. It just doesn't happen.
Hugo, again, this is another one of these speculative questions, but I was reading about the possibility of, if a spy is probably too strong a word, but that there might be someone within Trump's orbit who is releasing information about some of these documents. Have you been able to verify that or investigate that at all?
We did some reporting on this earlier in the week, and we kind of put it all together in terms of kind of where Trump world suspicions went. I mean, certainly at the start of the week when when the Mar-a-Lago kind of resort got searched by the FBI agents, I think there was a lot of initial suspicion that there might be, you know, aides close to the former president who were acting as confidential informants for the FBI. And they kind of centered on a couple of aides who were either leaving Trump's orbit or who had already left Trump's orbit. I actually went and spoke to those aides, and they told me that while they had been contacted, say, by the January 6th committee, they had not spoken to the FBI. And I think they also told their associates that, which meant, you know, by midweek, a lot of the suspicion had, you know, in Trump world and kind of within Trump's orbit had shifted towards maybe it was the help at Mar-a-Lago, and maybe it was the cleaning staff who knew the layout of the resort and knew where all the rooms were. And then at some point, I think the Secret Service got came under suspicion. But then by the end of the week, when the search warrant and return receipt got unsealed, and everyone saw that the FBI took a leather-bound box of documents and also went through, knew exactly where Trump's safe was and went through it, I think a lot of people then started wondering if it was actually someone even closer to Trump, people, you know, people including people in Trump's actual close family, because that's really closely held information. And I think the thing to take away from this is no one actually knows anything. And this is kind of classical, you know, classic Trump political intrigue, palace intrigue, and anyone who wasn't under suspicion at some point has come under suspicion.
There have been, and I'm looking at you, Lauren, there have been a number of attacks on FBI officials, I believe the judge was unable to go to synagogue or something because there were threats there. I do want to play a clip from Attorney General Merrick Garland, and he spoke last Thursday. He was concerned about the threats on a number of officials. Let's give that a listen, and then I'll ask you to respond.
Let me address recent unfounded attacks on the professionalism of the FBI and Justice Department agents and prosecutors. I will not stand by silently when their integrity is unfairly attacked. The men and women of the FBI and the Justice Department are dedicated, patriotic public servants. Every day, they protect the American people from violent crime, terrorism, and other threats to their safety while safeguarding our civil rights. They do so at great personal sacrifice and risk to themselves. I am honored to work alongside them.
I mean, Lauren, this is very worrisome, right?
It is, absolutely. I think that some of the rhetoric that has been coming out by Trump and by his supporters against the FBI, against federal law enforcement generally, against the Department of Justice is extremely dangerous. It's not a joke. You know, there are, as we can see, direct actions, violent actions that result from that rhetoric. And there's a direct line. And so it needs to stop.
In fact, that is something, Hugo, that former Vice President Mike Pence said. He said it needs to stop. And I thought that was, first of all, I was glad to hear him say that. And I thought it was interesting that he did.
Look, I think, you know, Pence has different political motivations than Trump does. And I think it pays for him politically to be seen as the guy, as you know, backstopping the FBI at a time when Trump isn't. So I think there are different considerations here. I think nonetheless, though, it's important to have kind of public officials also on the kind of Republican side, even you might even say like the MAGA Trump side, kind of trying to tamp down the rhetoric here and say, you know, the FBI was actually executing a court-approved lawful search warrant. I think people forget this sometimes. This wasn't, you know, a raid where the FBI just rocked up, you know, first thing Monday morning and, you know, shoved their way in. Like, you know, according to our reporting and others, you know, Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, you know, weighed searching Mar-a-Lago for several days. And this was a very careful step in a series of careful deliberations. And when the FBI went in, they went in with kind of plain clothes. They didn't go in with their blue vest that said, you know, FBI on the back, because they really didn't want to turn this into a big political thing. And so I think for Pence to come out and say that was actually a very important move to kind of reset the tone here.
In fact, there was a former president that said that the FBI, I believe he used the word raided, had raided his home.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, Trump really went after the FBI because he's been at loggerheads with the Justice Department and the FBI for the entirety of his presidency. And this was just a kind of continuation of his, you know, him lashing out at what he thought was kind of them targeting him.
I mean, Lauren, we don't know what are in these documents. So we know that he should not have them. I mean, they do not belong to him. But at the same time, if they were being shown to someone, or if they were being destroyed or used for some monetary reason, I'm just speculating here. What can the courts do? Can the courts do anything about that?
I mean, so the courts can act unilaterally, right?
Yes,
so,
correct.
Right. I mean, if we're talking about the criminal system, a prosecutor would have to decide to bring an indictment before a grand jury for a vote on, and then the grand jury, of course, would vote on the proposed charges and decide whether to return the indictment. And at that point, a prosecution would commence. So absolutely, there are, as we know from the crimes listed in the search warrant, those are the crimes that the Department of Justice is looking into, and those are the crimes for which they've already demonstrated to a magistrate judge that there was probable cause, that there would be evidence of those crimes in that place in Mar-a-Lago. Now, to be clear, the documents that have been seized, when a search warrant authorizes a search, it authorizes not just a search, but a seizure. And you have to have probable cause for both the search and for the seizure.
And the seizure is obviously the removal.
Exactly. So the fact that they have removed 26 boxes of documents, in addition to, it looks like, 11 different sets of documents with some sort of classification markings on them, indicates that all of those items that were seized, there is probable cause to believe that those items contain evidence of the crimes listed in the search warrant. Oh, which Glenn went through earlier.
Yeah, exactly. But we're almost up at a break here. There were a number of documents that were taken out in January, and then the ones that were taken out last week.
Right. I'm talking about just the ones taken out last week from the search warrant. The other thing I would say, you know, just that's helpful to think about the fact that this began, as far as we know, back in January. It might have been going on even earlier before that, but at least it became sort of public in January and February, that this had been going on for a while, with NARA trying to get these documents back, the DOJ trying to get them back, asking nicely, then issuing a subpoena, right? This is not something that, exactly, to paraphrase, that Merrick Garland woke up and said, oh, let's just go execute a search warrant. This was clearly a last resort.
We're going to talk more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing. We've been talking about the fact that former President Donald Trump is facing a series of investigations involving things like classified documents. We'll talk about election interference and the Trump Organization. Our guests are Lauren Uziel. She's a professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, also a former federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, also the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. Hugo Lowell is with us as well. He's a congressional reporter covering January 6th for The Guardian. Let me read a couple of comments here, and maybe I'll put this first one to you, Hugo. This is from Carlton, who happens to be a news intern here at WHYY. How do you believe this could impact Trump's reelection efforts, and could this make him ineligible for running again? Is it possible that this could be connected to the January 6th riot, or is it just a coincidence? Hugo, you want to take that first?
I think I'll start with the last part of that question. I think all indications so far, and based on our conversations with Trump's lawyers and their conversations with DOJ, this is very much focused on the documents at Mar-a-Lago and seem to be unrelated to January 6th. I think with respect to his re-election, though, I think it has kind of rattled Trump's legal team a lot and also his political circle in the way that there was discussion, you know, probably even, you know, a few weeks ago that Trump might wait to announce his re-election through the, you know, until after the midterms, that timetable has been brought forward considerably. And now aides are kind of discussing maybe announcing closer to Labor Day. And what they're trying to do with this is to put the Justice Department in a difficult position, because the DOJ is not supposed to get involved in politics. And Trump, I think, is betting that if he can announce before the DOJ moves forward with any sort of indictment or prosecution, then he can, after the fact, paint such an indictment, should it come, as a political gambit to try and take him out of the race.
Here's a sort of related email from PJ. If the affidavit was unsealed, this would give the Trump group a chance to use it for the right-wing media, he says, also to make assertions that they couldn't say under oath in open court. Let me put something to you, Lauren. This is from Patricia. I'm worried about the mishandling of classified documents by White House staff during his presidency. She goes on to say Jared Kushner supposedly used nuclear information with his dealings with the Saudis. And I guess the question is whether, and I think we're sort of learning that there have been sort of rules and regulations that previous presidents have followed, not to the letter of the law, all of them, but that Trump seemed to operate sort of outside of those bounds. And also the presidency gave him some protections that he doesn't have now as a former president.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that there were there was mishandling of classified information while he was in office, I mean, that crime has been charged against others, right? Not in his administration, in prior administrations. And so if the government uncovers that, then presumably, right, they might consider bringing charges in that regard. We don't know. I mean, we just don't know at this mm-hmm. point. Keep in mind that we didn't know about this until it happened, right? There's lots
True
that could be happening. In terms of investigation, we don't know if the Department of Justice is investigating mishandling of classified information by others in the Trump White House that happened during the presidency. I actually think that one of the reasons that statute wasn't listed in the warrant, I know Glenn mentioned it, right, that the mishandling of classified information, that's a separate criminal statute. That actually requires that it be done by someone with current access to the information, which Trump does not have. He's right. A former president. He has no access to that information. So that's probably my guess as to why that statute wasn't listed in the warrant.
Hugo, let me put something else on the table here. Rudy Giuliani testified yesterday before a grand jury. He found out that he's the target of a criminal investigation in Georgia, an attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Do we know this happened behind closed doors? Do we know what happened yesterday at the grand jury?
Only very generally. I mean, I checked in with Rudy's lawyer around the time or kind of after the testimony before the special grand jury in Georgia. And the sense was that he, you know, did answer questions. It's not like he just went there and kind of asserted his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. I mean, certainly I think that was one of the things people were discussing after it came out, that he was actually a target, one of many, of that investigation. Mm-hmm. But I think he did answer questions for some time. The one thing he didn't talk about, though, which would have been probably frustrating for Fannie Willis, the district attorney in Fulton County, is that he didn't want to talk about the discussions he had with the former president. He claimed that, you know, they were attorney-client privileged, they were executive privileged, and that he would not talk about them in any way. And that's pretty consistent with how he's approached all of these investigations. He's kind of given them enough, probably, so that, you know, he gets some credit for cooperating potentially down the line if this, again, results in an indictment, but also not enough, probably, to take down Trump by himself. You know, that was the feature of his testimony to the January 6th committee, and it sounds like it's the feature of his testimony to the Georgia criminal investigation here as well.
I mean, Lauren, we all, not all, but those who cared, heard multiple times the phone call that Trump made down to Georgia saying he wanted 11,780 votes, which would have given him, you know, the Georgia Electoral College vote. Where do you think the president stands on this? If his attorney, one of his attorneys, is the target of a criminal investigation?
Yeah, I mean, we'll have to wait and see what happens. I'm frankly shocked if Giuliani testified and didn't take the Fifth, given that he was told he's a target. I mean, that's the reason prosecutors tell people they're targets before they testify in the grand jury, is so that they can make an evaluation as to whether to take the Fifth. And usually somebody would if they're told they're a target. So that's
so
interesting.
You're saying the fact that he didn't is...
We don't know that he didn't, but it sounds like that it sounds like there's indications at least that if this is to believe what his lawyer said to the press, that he didn't. I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see if that's indeed true. The other thing to keep in mind is Georgia is one of the states that does not have a secrecy rule on grand jury proceedings as it pertains to witnesses. In other words, witnesses are not covered by the secrecy requirements as are prosecutors. And so I believe that if he wanted to, he could say what he said in the grand jury. He hasn't, at least so far. And so that's another thing to think about. I just don't know what it means, but we just don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot that we don't
know. We don't know.
Yeah, trying to fill in the blanks as best we can. Hugo, I was also reading that Senator Lindsey Graham is has been ordered by a federal judge to appeal before a special grand jury. I believe he's going to appeal that. What's the status of that? Do we know?
It sounds like Senator Graham's position is a little bit in limbo. I think he was desperately trying to make sure he didn't have to testify to that grand jury. I'm told by his team, both on the Hill and his lawyers, that he has been told he is not a target, at least at the moment. So that's interesting. But yeah. I think Lindsey Graham really does not want to testify to this grand jury. I think everyone you talk to connected to the January 6th investigations, every kind of former U.S. attorney that we've spoken to, everyone seems to think that the most dangerous investigation, the one that carries the most potential risk for all of these guys in Trump's kind of orbit, is probably going to be this Georgia criminal investigation into Trump's efforts to overturn the election in that state. And I think for that reason, I think a lot of people are very wary about going before this grand jury.
I mean, even if he were able to do that, he still wouldn't have had enough electoral votes, Hugo, to win the presidency.
Yeah, and I think the point to remember about Trump's efforts to overturn the election was that it was kind of multi-pronged and multifaceted. It wasn't just, even though Georgia is the state that's investigating here, it wasn't just in Georgia, right? I mean, John Eastman and other kind of lawyers who are working for Trump in the aftermath of the election, they were trying to target several swing states together. If you put all of them together, it would probably give him enough to somehow return to the White House. And so Georgia was just one of several states that Trump was targeting. He was trying to, his overarching plan was to have these states decertify the kind of Biden's win and send forward a slate of what they call alternate or fake, electoral certificates to Congress so that Mike Pence on January 6th could open the envelopes and say, oh, look, there are dueling slates of electors. I don't know which one to certify. And so we're just not going to certify those states, or we're going to send them back to the states to recertify them. And, regardless of what would have happened, that would have meant that Trump had enough electoral votes to take the presidency. And of course, Mike Pence declined to go with this. With this kind of scheme. And so this is what prevented Trump from executing that element of his plan.
Yeah, and Pennsylvania obviously was part of the plan. Yeah, go ahead.
Marty, the only other thing I was going to add is if Giuliani did testify, if he didn't take the Fifth in response to every question, and he gave selective testimony on some matters and then claimed attorney-client privilege on others, the district attorney, the Fulton County DA, can challenge the assertion of attorney-client privilege under what's known as the crime fraud exception. So it doesn't apply if the legal advice, well, first of all, the attorney-client privilege is narrow in and of itself. So she would first, could challenge whether it was even correctly asserted. And then if it was, there's an exception. You can't use it to shield information regarding the perpetration of a crime. So that, right, and that's going to take, again, on the subject of time, all this takes time, right? If that's litigated, that has to go through the system.
Well, let me shift to New York. I believe it was last week, Trump was questioned, I guess, by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James. Let me go back to you, Lauren, only because you used to work with the Southern District of New York. What's at issue there?
So this is actually not a case being investigated by the Southern District of New York, as far as we know. It's the Manhattan District Attorney's Office that's doing the criminal aspect, and then the Office of Letitia James, which is the New York State Attorney General's office, which we understand was working with the DA's office on some aspects, but she's pursuing her own civil case against the Trump Organization and potentially against Donald Trump. And what's interesting is with a civil case, you actually can use a witness's assertion of the Fifth Amendment against them, in the sense that a jury is entitled to draw an adverse inference, meaning that they can draw the inference that someone chose to take the Fifth Amendment because if they spoke, it would incriminate them, and that they can use that against them in a civil case. So that those are two, right? The criminal case and the civil case are related in the sense that both are looking into the inflation of Trump's organization assets in order to secure loans. The criminal aspect of that, as far as we know, is gone dormant. That was the issue that happened with the two special prosecutors who had been hired to work on that case, who resigned because the case evidently wasn't going to be charged by the new DA, Alvin Bragg. There's another criminal case against the Trump Organization and Weisselberg, the CFO of the Trump Organization, regarding the use of it's a tax fraud case regarding the giving to certain employees of taxable perks for which taxes were not paid. So that's
cars, apartments,
exactly,
things like that.
Private school tuition, things like that. And that's the case to which Weisselberg is expected to plead guilty today.
Yeah. What do we know about that, Hugo? What's going to happen today?
Well, I mean, I think it's already been expertly laid out. I mean, he's going to plead guilty today. I think the point to note with Weisselberg is even though there's kind of some limitations as part of his kind of plea agreement, one of the things he's not exempt from is he may have to testify against Trump if it comes to that. He may have to take the stand and testify against his boss, which would be pretty significant. I don't think we've seen that in any other investigation where we have such a senior figure in the Trump Organization testify against, you know, potentially testify against Trump. You know, I think this is something that the Justice Department has been trying to work on, you know, with their federal investigations connected to the classified documents and January 6th, and certainly what the January 6th committee has been trying to do is find someone, you know, to kind of flip, as it were, on Trump, and they've not been able to do that. So I think the fact that Weisselberg is now in this position is actually pretty significant.
And again, Lauren, you and I were talking about Weisselberg before going on the air and sort of feeling as if he didn't, he only got kind of a slap on the wrist, and whether that's significant or not.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, from the public reporting, and again, we haven't seen the plea agreement yet, but from the public reporting, it sort of almost looks and feels like a cooperation agreement. But yet, we're told in the public reporting that it's not a cooperation agreement and that he's apparently not going to testify against Trump, but he is going to testify, maybe if asked, against the Trump Organization. I've never seen anything like that.
Really?
Usually a cooperation agreement, a witness can't pick and choose, right? They're just either cooperating or they're not. And so, again, I just don't know. We have to wait and see what the plea agreement actually says. If he's agreeing to testify truthfully, then he's got to testify truthfully to everything he knows. And so we'll have to see where that goes.
Yeah. Final question to you, Hugo, about a minute before I have to say goodbye. Former Vice President Mike Pence kind of hinted at the fact that he'd be willing to talk to the January 6th committee. What do we know about that?
I think it's pretty unlikely. I mean, I've been covering that investigation for about 11 months, and we've heard kind of stuff like this and kind of fits and starts. I think at one point, you know, the chairman and the vice chair of the committee have gone around saying, you know, maybe, you know, Pence might come in to testify. We might call Pence. We might subpoena him. But that has been very much, you know, a boilerplate response from those two. I mean, they've really been talking only very generally about getting Mike Pence to come in before the committee. And I think Mike Pence's comments yesterday were also very, very vague. You know, he can come in and testify voluntarily to the January 6th committee at any time. He doesn't have to be subpoenaed. And then he also said that would be unprecedented if he was compelled to testify. And that's also not true. You know, we've had former vice presidents and actual sitting vice presidents testify to Congress in investigations before. So it was an interesting statement. I wasn't really sure what he was trying to say or what to make of it. But I think the likelihood that Pence comes before the January 6th committee at the moment is probably not that realistic.
This just came in from the New York Times a few minutes ago. Weisselberg has pleaded guilty to 15 felonies, admitted to conspiring with Donald Trump's company in a tax scheme. Well, my thanks to both of you for helping us sort of navigate through all these legal thickets. Hugo Lowell, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Congressional reporter covering January 6th for The Guardian. Lauren Oziel, thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. And we began with Glenn Gerstel, former general counsel for the National Security Agency. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.